Crossover Q is a podcast that openly discusses the Q cultural phenomenon and all its associated conspiracies, ranging from armed political conflict, child abuse, sexual abuse, racism, sexism, and apocalyptic fetishization. Listener discretion is advised.
So, just last week, I was at the doctor's office, okay? In full disclosure here, I have a bit of an anxiety problem that kind of flares up from time to time, and with the pandemic and everything, I was just feeling edgy and losing sleep, so I needed to go to the doctor and get on some medication, and I'm doing well. But as I was in the exam room, the nurse was taking my blood pressure and asking me all those questions about my symptoms and my prescriptions and whether or not I'd been exposed to COVID, all that stuff. And in the middle of this conversation, she suddenly gets real serious, looks me squarely in the eyes, and says, "COVID was created in a lab, you know." And I said, "Well, okay, what makes you say that?" And she said, "Oh, it's this whole Chinese military thing. The communists are coming to take over the world, and this is really just the first step." And I was nice to her. I really was. I was in the doctor's office. I didn't want to start a whole thing right there. But inside, I was thinking, "Lady, I just told you that I'm here because I'm struggling with anxiety." Okay, I'm here because I'm freaking out all the time and my heart is pounding out of my chest. And somehow you've decided that now is an appropriate time to break out the conspiracy theory? But you see, that's just it. QAnon doesn't care about what's appropriate and what's not. QAnon doesn't care if you're at the doctor's office or out on a first date or visiting with your grandparents. Q doesn't care if it alienates your kids, or if your spouse is packing their bags, or your church is being torn apart. All Q cares about is the next little piece of information, the next morsel of conspiracy, the next truth bomb you can drop on your friends and family. I was really hoping that after the election, things would start calming down. That since the storm never happened, maybe folks would just snap out of it. But then, of course, came the lies about the election, late night voting dumps, computers changing the results, and I thought, okay, maybe after the court cases and the votes are certified, maybe then we'll move on. And then the Capitol insurrection happened, and then the inauguration, and we keep crossing date after date, moment after moment, waiting for folks to wake up and shake the scales from their eyes. But friends, it's just not gonna happen that way. Oh, now they're talking about March 4th and a new Trump inauguration and the start of a whole new republic. And then when that doesn't happen on March 5th, there will be something else. And that's because Q is not a date on a calendar for these folks. It's not just a prophecy that will or won't be fulfilled, an event that does or does not take place. QAnon is a feeling, okay? It's a hit. It's a high that comes from thinking that that maybe you're onto something here, that you're putting the puzzle pieces together, that you are in the know and everyone else is just sheep. There's a power that comes from thinking like that, a euphoria that just is not easy to give up. Even if it doesn't turn out the way you think, you still keep going back to that well again and again. Every time there's another theory, another post, another cue drop, as they call it. And you get that same hit again and again. That's because QAnon isn't just a conspiracy. And it isn't just anti-Semitic propaganda like we talked about last week. No, QAnon is an addiction. And what we all need right now is just a little bit of sobriety. I'm Vicar Derek Kabilis, and this is Crossover Q. Episode 3, Empty Cages in Sinking Sand. So some of you have been emailing me at crossoverq@yahoo.com, and I really appreciate that. I hope you'll keep those emails coming, because I've had the chance to hear from folks who have lost friends, and whose families are being torn apart, and even from a couple of folks that are trying to get out of QAnon. And these folks talk about getting out of QAnon the same way you might hear someone talk about giving up smoking or alcohol or drug abuse, in that the will is there. They know that it's hogwash, and they know that it's hurting the folks around them. They know that it's warping their perception of reality. But nevertheless, they're struggling to give it up. And if that's you, my heart goes out to you. I say a prayer for you. I hope you keep fighting the fight, and I hope you get the help you need. Because some people will need help to get out of this thing. More and more psychological professionals are starting to understand the reality of conspiracy theory addiction. I'm going to put a link in the description of this episode to a website called theaddictioncenter.com that explains the warning signs of conspiracy theory addiction, how to spot it and how to treat it. And it's got some resources on there that you can turn to for help if you or someone you know has fallen down that dark rabbit hole. And these experts point to three factors that contribute to conspiracy theory addiction. And there are actually three very human needs that I think we all experience to some degree from time to time. Number one is the need to understand. Number two is the need for control. And number three is the need to belong and to feel special. What conspiracy theories like QAnon do is they exploit those needs, those basic fundamental desires that we all have in our lives. They manipulate them. Most of us get those needs met by our family, our friends, our churches. But to those who are still seeking understanding, those who are still seeking a measure of control, who need to feel like they belong and are part of a community, Q comes along and says, here, check this out. You want to know why the world is such a mess? Here's an answer for you. You want to feel like you're finally taking control of your life, then trust this plan. Do you need a community in your life? Well, right here is a veritable ocean of patriots just like you. And y'all get to be in on this big secret together. And guess what? At the end of the story, you all get to win. When the storm comes and the military takes over and Trump is pronounced the president and all the evil pedophiles hang at the end of a rope, then everyone will look at you and say how you were right all along. And every time that message comes across, whether it's from a post from Q, or a meme on the web, or meeting up with friends at an anti-mask rally, whatever it is, whenever that feeling of security and meaning and purpose comes across, boom, you get a dopamine hit to the brain. You see, that's the chemical that, among other things, helps cause addiction. It activates the pleasure-seeking part of your brain and causes that warm, fuzzy feeling you get when you eat sugar or take heroin, or for some, when you listen to conspiracy theories. And that dopamine reinforces the behavior. So you go back again and again, until it becomes a habit, until it becomes a compulsion, until it becomes a full-blown addiction. So it's fascinating. Back in the 50s and 60s, when scientists were first starting to figure out how this whole addiction thing worked in the brain, they did an experiment with rats. And what they'd do was put a rat in a bare, empty cage with nothing but two water bottles. One bottle had just plain old tap water, and the second bottle had water that was laced with morphine, a kind of opiate painkiller, almost like heroin. And what they found out was at first the rat would drink from both water bottles equally, until he kind of figured out that the second bottle made him feel all warm and fuzzy, so he'd start going back to the second bottle more and more and more. And he'd leave the first bottle alone and keep going back to the morphine bottle until finally the rat overdosed and died. And so this was the dominant view of how addiction worked for decades, right? That some people, for some reason, just have a predilection for the morphine bottle. Whether we're talking about actual painkillers, as we've seen in our society lately, or for alcohol, or pornography, or conspiracy theories, whatever it is, some folks will just keep going back to that bottle again and again until their life falls apart and or they just die. So the theory was that you just gotta get tough. You got to take it away from them. That the only way to successfully intervene is to take away the morphine, flush the cigarettes down the toilet, unplug the internet, or whatever. But what do you do when the morphine bottle lives on the person's cell phone, on their computer, on the television of your spouse, or your adult children, or even your elderly parents? How do you get tough in that situation? How do you take away the bottle? Years later, a scientist tweaked the experiment. He kept the same two bottles, one with plain water and one with morphine, but this time, instead of putting a rat in a bare empty cage, he put the rat in essentially an amusement park. He filled the cage with tunnels and burrow holes and spinning wheels and chew toys, and most importantly, he put other rats in there. And what they found is that while the rats would kind of play around with the morphine bottle a little bit, they were just too busy having fun with their friends to get wasted on it every day. They wanted to ride the wheel and burrow down the holes and chase one another through the tunnels. What they wanted, it turns out, was to live a real life, a full life. In short, the problem wasn't just the morphine. The problem was the empty cage. I can't help but think that maybe QAnon has started to take over because our cages are more bare than they've ever been. I saw some statistics this week put out by the American Enterprise Institute, a very conservative organization, mind you. It said a full 29% of Republicans and 27% of white evangelical Christians say that QAnon is either entirely or mostly true. That is just absolutely staggering. And it tells me that we must be working with some pretty empty cages out there, you know, empty of meaning, devoid of purpose, lacking in community and relationships. I know the pandemic has probably made it all the worse, right? So we've retreated into our smartphones and our reality shows. We've retreated into treating politics like it's some kind of a religion, all because everything else in our lives feels so false and flimsy. So of course we're turning to QAnon. Of course we're talking about political revolutions. That's what you do when you can't find meaning in your day-to-day life. Yeah, you have to manufacture it somewhere. And of course, we're still struggling with the opioid epidemic. Now, I don't have the research, but I'm willing to bet that if you mapped out those places in this country where the opioid epidemic is raging, I would say that you would find QAnon right there with it. I mean, I don't have any proof of that. I doubt anyone has really studied it, but I would put money on the idea that the Venn diagram between communities that struggle with pain pills and communities that are overtaken by QAnon is darn near a circle. Because it's the same lack of meaning. It's the same emptiness, the same void that both drugs are trying to fill. And that, my friends, is exactly why we need to have compassion. Why we need patience and mercy if we're all going to get through this thing together. This is our third episode, and if you've been listening thus far, then you know that we're not here to argue. We're not here to fight. We're not here to play that game. We're here to learn, to heal, and to love. So many folks think that ridicule is the best way to deal with QAnon. I see it all the time on television and the web, little jokes on the news about Q crazies or Q nonsense, puns about tinfoil hats, stuff like that. But you see, when all we do is get mad or make fun? When all that we can think to do is ridicule them or try to force them away from this thing that is hurting them, well, that's when we isolate them more and more. We drive them deeper and deeper into that bare, dank cage. When we abandon them, when we scream and yell, when we berate and harass, all we're doing is pointing them right back to the morphine bottle. Now, please hear me, okay? There is a time to set boundaries. I'm not saying that you have to let your Q friends and family harass you, all right? If you need distance, then you need distance, and it's totally okay for you to take it. If you think that you or your family might be in danger, then you need to put up a boundary and leave and go someplace else. I am not asking anyone to stay in a hostile or a perilous environment, okay? But for the rest of us, I'm reminded of this verse in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus says, and this is our bad translation, he says, "Truly I tell you, if anyone is angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you'll be liable to the council. And if you say, 'You fool,' you shall be liable to the fires of hell." Now, we have to unpack that a little bit. Because Jesus isn't saying that you're not ever allowed to be angry. That's not what that word means. No, in Greek, the word is orgizo, which doesn't mean angry so much as it means to become exasperated. It's the kind of word that you would use when describing the anger someone feels in the midst of an argument. You know how when you're arguing with someone and you get to that point where nothing you say is getting through, and you're talking past each other, and you feel like you're yelling at a brick wall, and you just go, "Ugh!" That's orgizo. It's about losing patience. It's about lacking mercy and humility in the heat of an argument. Likewise, the next line is, "Whoever says raka will be liable to the council." Raka was almost like a curse word in ancient Aramaic. It meant worthless, empty. It's something that you would say after someone else told you something that you totally disagreed with. A better translation would actually be something like bullshit. And finally, the last line is, "Whoever says more will be liable to the fires of hell." More is literally where we get our word moron. It means calling someone a fool, calling them an idiot. It's an insult. See, in this verse, Jesus isn't just warning you about having emotions. He's not simply talking about how you feel about someone else. He's talking about your reaction to someone in the context of a fight, okay? Someone who is specifically causing you frustration, who seems to be provoking you, who seems purposefully stubborn and perhaps even willfully ignorant, okay? The passage is about whether or not you allow yourself to take the bait, whether you let them get your goat. Now, this particular verse is about keeping an emotional kind of boundary, about not getting swept away by someone else's problem and making it worse for everyone involved. It's about keeping your feet firmly planted on the shores of emotional sobriety, so you can be there to reach out a hand when someone who's drowning is willing to take it. So do you remember quicksand? You know, that old trope in adventure movies where the hero would be walking along a path and suddenly, out of nowhere, they just fall into this goo that threatened to swallow them whole. I saw this meme the other day that said, boy, as an adult, quicksand is not as big of a problem as the cartoons made it out to be. Well, quicksand is real. And it's not as common as those old movies would have you believe, but it is a real thing, and people have gotten stuck in it, ranchers have lost animals to it, and people have actually died. Not because they drown in it. It's actually really hard to drown in quicksand, but because they were stuck in it for so long that they died of thirst or exposure, or even from passing predators. And it's a real shame, too, the wilderness experts will tell you, because no one has to die in quicksand. The human body is actually more buoyant than quicksand, so most of the time a person or an animal should be able to just walk right out. But the problem is that once someone starts to realize that they're sinking, they start to panic, and they flail, and they kick their legs, and they turn side to side, and literally drill themselves down deeper into it. So here's a tip. If you ever find yourself stuck in quicksand, or ever come across a neighbor who's stuck in it, here's what you do. Number one, stay calm. Don't flail, don't kick, don't freak out. Number two, slowly lean back and let your own buoyancy keep you afloat. And number three, slowly wiggle one foot until the pressure starts to release. And then wiggle the leg until you can gently and slowly lift it out. And when both legs are free, scoot and crawl your way to safe ground. Do you see where I'm going with all this? When you see someone you know struggling with QAnon, your instinct may be to rush in and pull them out, right? To argue them out of it, to set them straight and pull and tug and fight them out of the pit. But the problem is, if you go in flailing and they start to flail, they're only going to drive themselves in deeper. After all, if it is all true, if they really do have some kind of secret knowledge, right? If there really is a conspiracy and everyone else is brainwashed, then the internal logic says, of course, their friends and their family are going to be mad at them. Of course, they're going to be offensive. According to the theory, it all makes perfect sense. And so they just drill down deeper and deeper. What's it say in Proverbs 29? If a wise man argues with a fool, the fool only rages and laughs, and there is no quiet. Now, what you want to do, according to experts like Adam Grant from the Wharton School, and I've linked his article in the description, is you want to keep them calm. And then you want to ask questions that make them wiggle just a little bit. Get their mind making gentle circles until part of it starts to break free. Grant calls this approach motivational interviewing. And he says that the premise is that you can't force anyone to change, but you have to help them find the motivation to change themselves. And you do that by asking open-ended questions, listening thoughtfully, and then following up with more questions. And in effect, he says, what you're doing is holding up a mirror so that they can see their thoughts more clearly. And then once they do that, if they desire to change, you can help guide them toward a plan. But the thing is, we got to get out of the concept of winning an argument and into trying to understand. Trying to understand them so that they can understand themselves. So instead of blowing your top and saying, wow, these theories are just crazy and you really gotta let this go or else we can't be friends anymore, you might say something like, hey, you know, I'm concerned and I'd like to understand more of your feelings about X, whatever it is, QAnon, anti-vax, voting fraud, whatever. And then listen and ask more questions. Not questions like, why are you being so stupid? Not judging, but asking questions that allow you to express your concern and your desire to understand where they're coming from and what they're feeling. This is the kind of thing I do in my ministry all the time. Some preachers like to make a big show out of, quote, telling it like it is, right? Or laying down the law. But when someone believes something that's harmful, or they're behaving in a way that's destructive, my first resort is usually to ask questions. I try to be humble. I try to understand. And when you do that, when you put in the time, when you have the courage to actually sit in that conversation and not try to answer and solve everything for them, when you showcase your concern rather than your contempt, that's when they start to trust. That's when they start to listen and start to question themselves. Because at the end of the day, the amount of force it takes to actually pull someone out of quicksand is about 100,000 newtons, roughly the same amount of force it takes to lift a car. You're not going to be able to pull them out. And if you try, you're much more likely to hurt them or yourself in the process. No, what you gotta do is keep your feet on dry ground and try your best to keep them calm and invite them to wiggle. As we wrap up today, I want to ask you a question, dear listener. How's your cage looking? I know that we're in the midst of a pandemic, and here in Ohio, there's a foot of snow on the ground, and there's just not as much going on right now as there used to be, but that's why the question is all the more important. How's your cage looking? How full is your life? how are you participating in a community that supports and encourages you? How are you having fun? What are the relationships that give your life their purpose and meaning? And if you're lacking in those places, what are you doing to make the situation better for yourself? Because here's the thing. None of us can boast because we all have our morphine bottle, right? For some, it's literal morphine. Or for others, it's food or alcohol or QAnon or political outrage. It doesn't matter who you are. We all find ourselves ankle deep in the muck and mire of life from time to time. But here's the thing. It's pretty hard to help someone else get to dry ground if you are sinking yourself. And now I invite you to close your eyes if you'd like and take a deep breath. Release any tension you might have developed during this episode in your shoulders or your back and receive this blessing. May the love of God the Father, grace and peace of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit go with you and be with you, now and always. Amen.